From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. 63 years ago in Marion, Indiana, a black teenager narrowly escaped being lynched. On today's Fresh Air, he tells his story. James Cameron is 80 years old now and is the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum and the author of A Time of Terror, A Survivor's Story. Two of Cameron's friends were lynched that day in August 1930. Also, critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Martin Amis's new collection of essays, Visiting Mrs. Nabokov. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton is about to announce that Lloyd Cutler will be his new White House counsel, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President moved quickly to choose a replacement for Bernie Nussbaum, who resigned as counsel on Saturday after coming under fire for his role in the Whitewater affair. This isn't the first time Lloyd Cutler has been asked to come to the rescue of an embattled White House. He was called in to serve as Jimmy Carter's counsel in 1979 after Carter's first counsel, Robert Lipschitz, left under criticism. Cutler is one of the most respected members of the Washington legal establishment, a credential White House officials say they wanted. White House spokesman Dee Dee Myers said this morning a counsel of Cutler's stature would be reassurance to the press and the public that the White House is adhering to high ethical standards. Asked about the job this morning, Cutler said, "You don't look forward to it. You're asked to do it, and you have to do it." At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
A gay and lesbian organization says anti-homosexual violence declined last year, at least in the six major cities the group studied. But the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force says such violence still remains an epidemic out of control. The study's author says because victims typically underreport these crimes, the new numbers are only the tip of the iceberg. Today, the Pentagon announced it will extend its ban on smoking to create a smoke-free workplace. Smoking soldiers will still be able to find a place to light up, but their choices will be limited. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
Soldiers and civilian employees have faced smoking restrictions in the Department of Defense since the mid-80s, but today's announcement takes the process a step further. Any workplace, whether it's an office or a tank, will be smoke-free when the new orders take effect a month from now. Sherry Wasserman, the Pentagon's chief of environmental security, says the goals are to protect the health of all DOD workers, maintain and improve the military readiness of the armed forces, and save money.
There is compelling evidence that this policy will result in savings in terms of lives saved, health costs avoided, work hours lost to sickness, and reduced housekeeping and maintenance expenses for our many buildings.
Smoking will be allowed in some base housing and even in designated rooms on submarines. Also, commissaries will continue to sell cigarettes at subsidized prices. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Charles Redman, the U.S. envoy to the former Yugoslavia, met with Serbian officials in Belgrade today. Redman's trying to convince Serbia to back a Bosnian peace plan being worked out by Bosnian Muslims and Croats. But Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic was reportedly skeptical of the plan, as were Bosnian Serbs at the meeting. Milosevic called the Muslim-Croat accord their internal thing and said the Serbs were not obliged to participate. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 6.75 at 3849.47 in heavy trading of 288 million shares. This is National Public Radio News. The senior Israeli commander in the West Bank says faulty troop deployment at a mosque in Hebron allowed the recent massacre there to take place. Major General Danny Yatom testified today before a State Commission of Inquiry. He said there should have been another five security guards at the mosque. Yatom added that the army didn't consider restricting settlers from carrying weapons onto the site because officials simply didn't imagine a Jew would attack. Palestinians complain the commission is focusing too narrowly on the massacre and not enough on what they consider to be the everyday harassment by settlers. President Clinton will propose a $13 billion makeover of the nation's unemployment system tomorrow, NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The president will unveil his Workforce Security Act during a White House briefing tomorrow. The program recommends extending jobless benefits for displaced workers who are training for new careers. Mr. Clinton is also expected to propose combining all state and federal unemployment programs into one-stop career centers where the jobless could apply for benefits, receive counseling, and sign up for training. The president will ask Congress to allow community colleges and other local groups to compete with government-run programs for federal dollars to retrain dislocated workers. Assistant Secretary of Labor for Employment and Training, Doug Ross, says the administration wants to take what is a fairly passive employment system and turn it into a very active re-employment system. The $13 billion price tag for the program would be spread over 5 years. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
The Postal Service wants to raise the cost of a first-class stamp by 3 cents. The Postal Governing Board today proposed an across-the-board increase of 10.3% for most classes of mail. That includes a 32-cent first-class stamp. The Postal Rate Commission still has to approve the change. Brazil's foreign minister says the UN Security Council should open up its membership to developing nations like his. Celso Amorim told reporters today that would make the council a more legitimate and effective body. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. On a hot summer night in 1930, 16-year-old James Cameron was nearly lynched in Marion, Indiana, by a mob of Ku Klux Klansmen and their sympathizers. Cameron was in jail, charged with a crime, murder and rape, he did not commit. James Cameron may be the only African-American to survive a lynching. He's written a book about this time called A Time of Terror. He's also the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum, located in Milwaukee. The museum has been housed in several buildings in the city and is closed temporarily while Cameron raises money for renovations. I spoke with James Cameron about what happened that August night in 1930. He told me he was riding in a car with two young men he knew from the neighborhood, Thomas Shipp and Abraham Smith. Smith said he wanted to rob someone. I asked James Cameron what happened next.
Well, I wanted to get out of the car. I didn't want to have anything to do with them. So they kept on driving. They wouldn't stop the car. And we drove out to a place past the 38th Street Bridge and the Soldiers' Home and down a lane called Lover's Lane. And there we came across an automobile that had been parked on the sidelines, and there was a man and a woman in the back seat. Now, on the way to this car from Thomas's car, I had a feeling of something inside me saying, go back, go back, go back. But I kept following them as if I was tied to them. I don't know what it was that drove me. Maybe it was the idea that I wanted to show them that I was as brave as they were or what. But anyhow, I felt that anything could have crawled out from under the rocks that night and bit us. We could hear the frogs croaking. We could hear the insects cricking. And we could hear the splash of the fish as they jumped in the river. But I kept right on following them as if I was tied to them. We came to the car, and they pulled a gun out from their pocket. Thomas had the gun in his bib overalls. And he handed it to Abe, and Abe handed it to me and said, here, you hold him up. And foolishly, I walked up to the car. I said, stick him up. And the people got out of the car, and I noticed the man when he got out, and I noticed the woman when she got out. Her face was pale and lovely and frightened. And as soon as the man got out of the car, I recognized him immediately. He was a friend of mine.
Someone, you had a shoeshine stand.
Yeah, I was his shoeshine boy. He was a young man, 23 years old. I was 16. And he'd always tip me and laugh and talk, and he wouldn't let anybody shine his shoes but me. I came to my senses at that particular moment, and I turned around, gave the gun to Abe, and I said, here, I'm not going to have anything to do with you guys. And I left. I ran down the road as fast as I could go. And it was dark that night. I stumbled and fell, and a car came towards us, and I saw the headlights. I ducked over into some weeds to try to keep the headlights from seeing me. And I was afraid some snake or something might bite me as I lay there in the woods waiting for the car to go by. And when it passed, I got up and ran even faster. But I had run about two or three blocks away from the scene of the crime when I heard some shots said, bang, 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 just like that. And I had been foolish, I know, but I had not been trained to be an insane person. I was not about to go back there to see who was shooting who. So I kept on running until I got home. And when I got home, my mother was standing up. She was sitting up waiting for us. And she never went to bed unless all her children were accounted for. When she opened the door, I stood there sweating and panting like a horse that had been in a race.
She knew something was wrong.
Yes, the way I was gasping for breath and everything, and the look in my eyes. You know, a mother can look at a offspring and tell when something's wrong by looking into their eyes. She knew something was wrong. She asked me, "What's the matter? Are you in some kind of trouble?" I said, "No, Mom, I've been playing football over in Old Man Henderson's field with the boys." She knew I was lying. She said, "Go on upstairs and go to bed. I'll talk to you in the morning."
Let me just stop you there. And you mentioned the fact that when you held this couple up, you recognized the man, and he was someone that came to your shoeshine area.
Yes.
Did he recognize you, do you think?
No, he did not. He did not recognize me, huh?
Now, you went to sleep, or at least you went up to your room.
I went up to my room and pretended to be asleep. But I couldn't sleep. I kept pacing up and down, wondering what had happened back there at Lover's Lane, who was shooting who, and had Tommy and Abe run away, or were they out there yet, and all that stuff. These questions kept running through my mind, and seemed like the veins in my legs wanted to just jump out.
Now, the police arrived at your house in the middle of the night, banged on the door, came and dragged you out of the house. Mm-hmm. What did they say you had done?
When they awakened me upstairs after Mother let them into the house, they came upstairs and pulled the sheets back off me where I had tried to hide myself, but I could still feel the beams of their flashlights coming through the sheet. And they pulled the cover back and told me to get up and put my clothes on. I got up and put my clothes on very shakingly, tremblingly, and one of the police said, "Have you told your mother what you and those boys done tonight?" I said, "No, I haven't done anything." And he said, "The hell you haven't," said, "you went out here and you shot a white man and you raped a white woman." And I said, "Oh, no, I don't know anything about that." And they said, "Come on, the chief wants to see you." So they took me downstairs, and downstairs my mother was having fits. She was acting like a crazy woman. She was saying, "What has my boy done? Lord, have mercy, forgive me, help me. Jesus, what has my boy done?" She was telling the police that, "He's my only son. Please don't take him. What has he done? Take me instead of him." Hmm. And when I look back at it now, and I see my mother standing there in the doorway, wringing her hands and telling the police to take her instead of me, I can never forget that. It just comes back to me all at once.
Well, certainly the way you're talking about it, it sounds almost as like you're reliving it, that the memory and the details are so powerful.
They are powerful. When a traumatic event happens like that to a young person, or even to an older person, it makes an indelible imprint on the mind.
Now, you were taken over to the police station and interrogated there. Describe what the interrogation process was like.
Well, the police station interrogation process was nothing at all. All they asked me was my name and address and where I lived. That was what the sergeant asked me in the booking room there at the police station. But outside the police station, on a flagpole, was the shirt of the victim who had been shot. The white man who had been shot, his bloody shirt was hanging on the flagpole of police headquarters there in Marion, Indiana, for the whole city to see.
And that was a kind of a flag, a call to action.
Yes, kind of a waving a flag in front of a bull, waving a red flag in front of a bull, that's what you might call it. And after they got through asking me these few questions in the booking room there at police headquarters, they allowed me to go into a room where the sheriff was sitting down at his desk. And when I went in that room, the sheriff told me to have a seat, and I had a seat. He said, "Do you know Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Were you with them tonight?" I said, "Yeah, I was with them for a little while." And he said, "Where'd you boys go? What'd you do? How'd you meet them?" And I told him all about how I'd met Abram Smith and Thomas Shipp that night at a place where we were pitching horseshoes, and I was ready to go home, and they offered me a ride. And he says, anything happened while you was in the car? And I said, yeah. I said, Abram said they wanted to hold up somebody and get some money to buy a new automobile. And I told him I didn't want to have anything to do with anything like that. So I tried to get out of the car, but they wouldn't stop the car. And the sheriff said, why wouldn't they stop the car? I said, I don't know. They kept on driving. So he said, what happened when you got out into Lover's Lane? I said, well, we went through a dark thicket part of the brush, and we came upon a car that was parked on the road. And I said, they told me to go and hold the people up, and I told them that I was scared to hold the people up because what if the people in the car had a gun? And they said, oh, no, they haven't got a gun. So we'll stand over here on the side, and we'll make out like we got a gun, too. So very foolishly, I took the gun, and I walked up to the car, and I said, stick them up. And that's when the man and the woman got out of the car.
Did the sheriff believe you?
He did not believe me, no. No, he didn't believe me. The police pounced on me and almost tried to kill me right there. Then after they tried to kill me and didn't succeed in doing that, they grabbed me and threw me in the chair alongside the desk where I had been sitting and talking to the sheriff. And then the sheriff put a piece of paper in front of me, and he says, here, sign this. Well, my mother had always told us to always look at something before we sign it to see what we were signing. So foolishly, I looked over and tried to read what the sheriff had written down on the paper, and one of those policemen hit me upside the head. It felt like a wrecking ball up against a building somewhere. I saw a million stars. He knocked me out of my seat, and I hit the floor. They snatched me back up and threw me in the chair and said, damn it, the sheriff said, sign it, not read it.
So what did that piece of paper say? What did you sign?
I didn't find out what it said until a year later when I had my trial. It said that Thomas Shipp had killed the man and that Abram had raped the woman. But the thing of it is, at my trial a year later, the woman said she hadn't been raped. That was why the judge repudiated the conversation and threw it out.
Now, after this interrogation, you were locked up in the jail. When did you notice a crowd begin to gather around the jail?
The very next morning, when daylight approached. See, I'd been arrested on the evening of August the 6th, 1930. And by the time they put me in jail, it was around 2 a.m. And when they put me in this jail, I was in there about 3 hours from 2 to 5 talking to the men that were in the cell block where I was incarcerated because they all crowded around me and wanted to know what was the matter and what had I been arrested for and what had I done and all that. So I told them the same thing I told the sheriff. I didn't know anything about I should have kept my mouth shut or nothing like that, you know. And when I got through telling my story, they said, oh, hell, I wish I was out of this here place. Because there was 30 black men in there who had been caught riding a train through Marion, and they had been given 30 days for vagrancy in the city of Marion, Indiana.
So did they know the kind of trouble you were in?
They figured it. Yes. They began to wish they were out of the town right away when they found out what kind of trouble I was in.
Now, when this crowd began to gather, did they have signs? Were they shouting things up to the jail?
No, they were just shaking fists up at the jail and looking at the windows and everything like that. And they were gathering in small knots of people, 8 to 10 people at a time, and the crowds kept getting bigger and bigger all during the day.
What did the sheriff, what did the other police officers do?
Well, the sheriff had police officers there from Huntington, Alexandria, Anderson, Muncie, Fort Wayne. There were plenty of police officers there to stop the action of the mob. But the sheriff gave orders not to shoot out into the crowd because there were women and children out there. So when the crowd heard that order given, whereby the reinforcements could not do anything without the sheriff's permission, when the mob heard that, some big men, 4 or 5 of them, asked for a sledgehammer, and they began to pound around the front door of the jail, which was ironclad. They began to pound the mortar and bricks around it, and after an hour's time, after their hands had been bleeding with blood from holding the handle of the sledgehammer in their hands, where they formed water blisters, and then the water blisters busted, and then the blood began to run. They finally mesmerized all the bricks and border around this casing, this hole in this iron door. And then they reached in and grabbed it and snatched it out with their bare hands. And then the jail was theirs.
My guest is James Cameron, and he's the author of a book called A Time of Terror. And the book is about the time back in 1930 when he was nearly lynched. He was 16 years old. A mob dragged him from prison where he was being held. They put a noose around his neck, but miraculously they didn't follow through on the threat. And he is the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum, located in Milwaukee. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Cameron, author of A Time of Terror. Now, you mentioned earlier that there was the shirt of the murdered man on the flagpole. There were also news reports on the radio of an impending lynching. There were also newspaper reports.
Yes, that's right. That's true. Yes, people from as far away as Gary, Indiana, came down to see if anything was actually going to happen.
So did the report say that we expect a lynching?
Yes. Yes, people were expecting that.
Now, this crowd broke into the jail. They took Smith and they took Ship first before they got to you.
I was a cleanup target.
You watched them drag these two men from the jail. What did you see?
I saw them beat him unmercifully. They beat Tommy first. The amazing thing is they took Tommy out of his jail cell block, beat him to death right there in front of my eyes, and then they drug him around to the side of the jail and hung him on the barred windows of the cell block where Abram was incarcerated. And no doubt Abram was looking out the window and seeing them hang Tommy on the windows of his cell block.
You knew that Tommy was dead?
Oh, yes. We knew that Tommy was dead when they drug him out of sight because someone had ran a crowbar through him several times.
Now, you said you watched him knowing that you were the third person in this group. You watched knowing that you were next.
No, I wasn't next at that time. After they got through hanging Tommy on the window, they came back and got Abe out and hung him. And then they came back and took Tommy down from the jail window where they'd hung him and drug him through the streets like a dead horse. These 16 and 17-year-old white boys did that. And they drug him up to the courthouse tree and hung him alongside of Abe. And after 15 or 20 minutes of having their pictures taken and everything, beside the two bodies that were hanging on the trees, they came back to get me.
You mentioned the pictures taken, and on the cover of your book, there's a picture of Ship and Smith hanging from the trees, and then the mob around them smiling, grinning at the camera, a very chilling photograph.
That's what makes that photograph the most famous lynching picture, because of the people in it. If you cover the people up, you just got a lynching of two blacks. But when you remove your hand and you see the expressions on their faces, that's what adds the importance to the picture. That's the same picture the Ayatollah Khomeini held up to the people in 1979 when they ran the Shah out of Iran. He held this up at an international news conference, this picture. He held it up and said, "This is the way America treats her blacks." But he didn't mention about the 900 heads he had cut off so far since he had been brought back from exile of dissidents who didn't believe in his line of Muslim.
Did you recognize anyone in that crowd?
Oh, no. I didn't recognize anybody in the crowd.
You write that parts of clothing of these two gentlemen were ripped off and sold as souvenirs.
Oh, yes. Mobs always do that. If it's not the clothes, it's the toes or fingers or genitals or parts of the skulls or shin bones or something.
Now, was there any investigation later on into the lynchings? Was anyone ever charged with a crime?
No one was ever charged with a crime. In those kind of cases where white folks lynched black people, there's always an investigation, but the investigation always turns out to be that the blacks were lynched by parties unknown.
So no one was ever charged?
No, no one was ever charged. Yet they had the names of 27 known members of the mob. They didn't even call them up before the grand jury for questioning.
How much of an organization was the KKK in Indiana?
Oh, in Indiana, at one time during the Roaring Twenties, they had over 500,000 members in their organization. They had a guy there named David Curtis Stevenson, who was really a spellbinder when it comes to recruiting membership into the Ku Klux Klan. In 2 years' time, he became a multimillionaire, selling those sheets and hoods for $10 a piece, plus all the other paraphernalia that went along with the Klan outfits.
Did you think, or was it ever proved, if the KKK was actually behind and organized the lynchings?
Oh, everybody knew that, sure. But they couldn't prove the person's names, you know. Yet they knew the names, but they couldn't prove it.
After these two young people were hung from the tree, they went back to get you.
Yes.
And you describe hearing the chants, "We want Cameron, we want Cameron.
That was the second time after they failed to get me the first time. The first time they came up to the jail after they had hung Abe and Tommy on the tree, they came back up to the jail and they told us to divide ourselves and get on each side of the cell block. So about 15 or 20 blacks got on one side of the cell block and 10 blacks and these four whites got on the other side of the cell block. And the mob came in and said, "Cameron is in here." I said, "Where is he?" Now, in these 30 men who had been caught riding a train through Marion and given 30 days in jail for vagrancy, one of those men had a 16-year-old son, and he was my age, my height, my complexion. We could have passed for twin brothers, so much did we look alike. Well, at any rate, the mob was questioning this young kid and asked him his name. He told him his name was Charles Haynes, and they asked me my name, and I told them my name was Henry Burton. I wasn't about to tell them my name was James Cameron after I'd seen what they'd done to Tommy and Abe. So just then the sheriff came in. He was a two-gun man. He had one gun in his holster, a pearl-handled pistol, and the other one in his hand as he came into the jail, but it was hanging limply down by his side, not pointing at anybody. And he was sweating like somebody had thrown a bucket of water in his face. He was very harried. And he told the mob leader, said, "Come on, let's get the hell out of here." So you've already hung two of them, so that ought to satisfy you. And then the mob turned around and went back downstairs. And they told this 15,000 to 20,000 people out there waiting for my presence that Cameron's not in there. And they said, "Yes, he is, and we want him." And then they began to yell for me like a favorite basketball or football player. They said, "We want Cameron, we want Cameron, we want Cameron." And I thought I would die.
Mm. James Cameron's book about his nearly being lynched is called A Time of Terror. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air. We'll hear more from James Cameron in the second half of the show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with James Cameron about how he survived a lynching by a mob in 1930. Cameron is the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee and the author of A Time of Terror, A Survivor's Story. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Visiting Mrs. Nabokov, a new book of essays by British writer Martin Amis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton has named Washington attorney Lloyd Cutler as special counsel to the president. Cutler replaces Bernard Nussbaum, who resigned this weekend in connection with his handling of the Whitewater affair. The president praised Cutler in making the announcement at the White House today.
In Lloyd Cutler, the White House has secured the service of a man of seasoned judgment, impeccable professional credentials, and the highest ethical standards. He'll provide a firm, uncompromising, and steady hand in a position of the utmost importance to me and to my administration.
In brief remarks, Cutler said he was honored to serve the president. The 76-year-old attorney called himself a senior citizen and said for that reason he agreed to take the job just for several months. Congressional Republicans continue to call for hearings into the Whitewater affair. GOP Whip Newt Gingrich said on NBC today that Congress has an obligation to investigate and inform itself and the country. Special Counsel Robert Fisk, who's looking into Whitewater, has said congressional hearings would pose a severe risk to his investigation, but Gingrich disputed that, saying Congress shouldn't give up its legislative responsibility. Israeli police have arrested the leaders of four Jewish militant groups following the Hebron massacre. Police say a fifth leader remains at large. The men head movements which support violence against Palestinians. They're being held without trial, a tool Israel usually uses against Arabs. The government says it's also starting to disarm radical settlers in the West Bank. For the second time in less than a week, China has detained a well-known student leader from the 1989 Tiananmen Square uprising. In a wide-ranging crackdown, police have now detained at least 14 dissidents in the past 7 days. Matt Forney reports from Beijing.
Police took in Wang Dan while he was eating dinner with his family. He'd been told last week to leave Beijing during China's rubber-stamp National People's Congress, which opens Thursday, but said he refused. The latest detention puts even more pressure on Secretary of State Warren Christopher. He arrives Friday with human rights topping his agenda. In past months, visiting U.S. officials have said they want to extend China's low-tariff, most-favored-nation trade status, although Washington must justify that by saying China has improved its human rights record. China's position has been consistent. It holds the principal human right is the right to maintain a reasonable living standard, and foreign countries have no authority to impose their views on Beijing. For National Public Radio, I'm Matt Forney in Beijing.
A new report says 1 in 10 Americans relies on charity to eat. The report by Second Harvest, the nation's largest food bank, says children make up 43% of those receiving food aid, although they're only 26% of the overall population. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 4.5 points to end at 3851.72. Declines led advances. This is NPR. The American Public Transit Association predicts a bleak future of overcrowded highways and smog unless public transit budgets go up. At a news conference today, the association's president said local transit agencies expect budget deficits of 40% by the year 2000 unless they get more money from the federal and local governments. The group pointed to new federal mandates that increase transit costs, such as compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act, new fuels required by the Clean Air Act, and mandatory drug tests for transit workers. The United States has urged the Bosnian Serbs to yield territory and join a budding Croat Muslim federation to preserve Bosnia. Charles Redman, the U.S. envoy to the former Yugoslavia, met with Serbian officials in Belgrade today. Kathy Jenkins reports for the BBC.
The Belgrade talks were the start of American efforts to bring the Serbs on board the latest peace initiative for Bosnia. The American envoy, Charles Redman, said he had come with no specific proposals, The central issue, he said, was to find out what the Bosnian Serbs thought of the proposed Muslim Croat Federation in Bosnia and whether or not they were interested in expanding it, and to see whether the initiative could move into a second phase with the Serb side involved. Mr. Redman stressed that whatever the obstacles, momentum was crucial. Backed by the Americans, Croats and Muslims are currently discussing the details of their proposed federation, which was agreed in Washington. The creation of a federation would involve territorial concessions from the Bosnian Serbs, who, after nearly 2 years of war, control about 70% of the territory.
Kathy Jenkins in Belgrade. Unemployment in the 12 member nations of the European Union is up. The EU reports today that more than 19 million people were jobless in January, almost 2 million more than January of last year. The overall unemployment rate is 10.9%. Spain had the highest jobless rate at nearly 23%. I'm Laura Kanoy, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Let's continue our interview with James Cameron. In 1930, he was dragged from the Marion, Indiana prison by a mob who beat him and nearly lynched him. Cameron was in jail, accused of rape and murder. It was later proved these were crimes he did not commit. A year after the attempted lynching, James Cameron was found guilty of being an accessory before the fact to voluntary manslaughter. He was sentenced to 2 to 21 years and served 4. In 1993, Indiana Governor Evan Bayh granted Cameron a full pardon. In the first part of our interview, Cameron told us how he watched from his jail cell as his 2 friends were lynched by the mob. Then the mob came looking for him. At first, Cameron was able to hide by giving a false name. But the mob came back a second time. I asked James Cameron how he was finally recognized.
They recognized me because no one in the cell block would tell who I was. And they threatened to hang every damn nigger in the jail if they didn't tell where Cameron was. And half the blacks in the jail, part where I was, out of these 30 blacks that was in there with me, half of them fell down on the floor and began to cry and grovel around and hug the pant legs of the mobsters and kissing their hands. And they were like babes lost in a wood somewhere.
How then were you identified in the jail cell?
When the mob gave the command to take all of us out in lynches, the other 16-year-old boy, his father, who was one of the train riders, he took his hand and pointed, and it was shaking like a leaf in the wind. He said, "There he is, mister. It wasn't none of us." And when he said that, all those who had been crawling around on the floor denying that I was there, they finally said, "Yes, sir, that's him, Mr. White Folks. It wasn't none of us." And that's how they identified me.
Well, they did identify you and dragged you from your cell. You describe people beating on you, children spitting on you as you were dragged outside.
And as the police cleared the path through the mob so I could get up to the tree, which was just one block away from the jail where Tom and Abe were hanging, as the police cleared the path, I looked over into the faces of people as they were beating me along the way up to the tree. I was pleading for some kind of mercy, looking for a kind face, but I could find none. And they got me up to the tree, and someone said, "Where's the rope?" They got a rope, and they put it around my neck, and they began to push me under the tree. And that's when I prayed to God. I said, "Lord, have mercy and forgive me my sins."
Now, I'm sure you've been asked this before, but what were the thoughts that moment before you thought you were going to be hanged?
Well, I was ready to die. I wanted to leave a world full of so many false and deceitful people. I was ready to die.
But you heard a voice. What did the voice say?
The voice said, "Take this boy back. He had nothing to do with any killing."
Did anyone else in that crowd hear that voice?
No. 4 years later, after 1 year awaiting trial and then 4 years in prison, I came back to Marion, Indiana, and I asked people, and they said, "You were just lucky we didn't hear any voice."
So the crowd, the frenzy of the crowd died down?
Oh, yes, in an instant. And no human voice, honest to God, could have quelled the fury of that mob that night. It had to be a miraculous intervention.
So how do you understand what that voice was?
I understand that it was a voice to save me for something that God had plans for me to do.
And the crowd literally parted as you stumbled then back to the police station.
Yes, half a block away. And the sheriff was out there, and he said, I'm going to try to get you out of here for safekeeping. Well, hell, it was too late for that. The decent-loving white people and blacks had been calling him up all morning, telling him to get us out of there and take us down Indianapolis for safekeeping. But he wouldn't do it. Of course, I found out later after I got out of prison, and I went back and started questioning people about it, reading all the newspaper accounts and everything, and then from what I could remember myself. So I wrote a book about it, A Time of Terror.
Where, then, did the police take you next? And I'm wondering even how safe you felt, because they weren't able to protect you from the mob that broke into the prison. How did you think they could protect you if they were going to even take you out of town?
Well, you see, that's the trouble that black people have to face in this country. Sometimes the police do more damage to you than the mob would have done. And that was the thought in my mind. What were the police going to do? Were they going to take me out and kill me because the mob had failed to lynch me? They put me in the car first by myself. And I noticed as I got into the car, there was a high-powered rifle and a couple of shotguns leaning up against the door. And I wondered, right away, did they think I was going to be foolish enough to try to grab one of those guns and shoot my way out? How could a 16-year-old boy do something like that when he didn't know whether those guns were loaded or unloaded? Well, they put me in the back of the car, down on the floor, and put the mat over me. And they said, get your damn black ass down on this floor. I'm not going to get hurt protecting a damn nigger like you. That was the first thing they did. Then the car took off with the wheels squealing. And it was as if they were giving notice to the mob out in front that somebody was making a getaway. They took me over to Huntington, Indiana, a small jail. And there in that jail, there was a young white girl in there, about 17, 18 years old. And you could look at her and tell that she was mentally deranged.
She was in prison there.
She was in jail, but she was in there because she was mentally deranged. Mm-hmm. She had lost her mind. And when I looked at that young girl, my heart went out to her despite all the trouble I was in. And they put me in a cell next to an old white man whose hair was as white as snow. And that old white man, I'll never forget him. He was the sorriest old white man I've ever seen in my life. I've never met anybody like him since or before. He said, son, said, I heard the police talking to the turnkey when they brought you in here. He said, my son and I had an argument this morning. He said I was arguing with him not to go over to Marion. So he said he might have been one of those, put that rope around your neck for all I know. He said he had me put in here and try to make out like I'm crazy. And he says, I'm sorry for what the people did to you over in Marion. He said maybe my son was one of them. He says, I wonder when will people ever stop and learn how to let the law take its course. And he was had tears in his eyes, and he had the bluest eyes I've ever seen in any white man. And they were the eyes of a saint, you might say. And he kept saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I didn't say a word to him. I just kept looking him in the eyes. He was talking, and I'm sure that there was an empathy between him and I as we looked into each other's eyes, an empathy that sometimes binds people stronger than bands of steel to each other as far as feelings are concerned.
James Cameron's book about nearly being lynched is called A Time of Terror. We'll continue with this story after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to James Cameron and his story of nearly being lynched. Well, there was a sheriff Bradley, who took you under his wing. This was a little bit later on.
Yes.
And said, look, I'll be a father to you. You be a son to me.
Mm-hmm.
Did he think you were innocent?
Yes, yes. Yes, he knew I was innocent. Yes, he knew it instinctively. But after I left that old white man in London, who was sorry as he could be, they took me on down a Pendleton, Indiana, but on the way to Pendleton, they stopped through Marion again. They said, "We're going through Marion again, nigga." I thought that was strange because that was a place I wanted to be from, not to go back to. And they stopped on the outskirts of Marion instead of keeping on the highway and going on down to the Indiana State Reformatory at Pendleton for safekeeping. They went through the city of Marion. And when they got into Marion, they were selling newspapers. Two Negroes lynched here last night. Extra, extra, extra.
You could hear that?
Yes. And they bought a paper and they pulled a mat back off my head on the floor of the car and said, "Look here, nigga, how's that?" And they showed me the picture of Tom and Abe hanging on the tree.
Well, they also drove by the tree, didn't
they? They drove by the tree and they said, "Look, this niggas are still hanging on the tree." And they said, "Look how the necks have stretched." And then I raised my head up to try to look through the window at a slant. And they said, "Get your damn head down in here. And we're not going to get hurt protecting a damn nigga like you." And then one of them said, "Let's put a 20-foot rope around this nigga's neck and turn him loose. And then if he gets through the crowd, we let him go free." And they got a big laugh out of that. Mm-hmm. They were just laughing all over themselves. It was a big deal. And I'm laying there seething with racial hatred. First time in my life knowing what real hatred was. I wanted to kill a white person. I didn't care whether it was a baby or a blind, crippled, crazy or what, old or young, just so I could kill a white person. I had that hatred building up in me.
You mentioned the fact that when the police were taking you back through Marion for the second time mentally working on your head, that you felt like you wanted to kill a white person and you didn't care.
Yes, right.
How long did you feel that way?
Until Sheriff Bradley got a hold of me.
And he was the sheriff who...
He was a good sheriff that wanted me to treat him like a father and he'd treat me like a son. And that was a man that broke up all the racial hatred I had in my heart.
You also write that while you were in prison, a number of people, both black and white, came to the prison to apologize for what happened.
Yes, you'd be surprised. I was really surprised. So many white people came and apologized. They were sorry and all that.
Was that enough?
It wasn't enough, but it helped.
Mm-hmm. When did you want to write about what happened to you?
As soon, 2 weeks after I was in prison. The first 2 weeks, they kept me in quarantine. And then after quarantine period, they let me out into the general prison population. And as soon as I got out into the general prison population, the whites and blacks came up to me, those who were, you might say, running the prison. They said, "Cameron, man, you got a hell of a story. Why don't you write it?" And that's when I began to write it. And then, of course, we smuggled in newspapers and things like that, and I was able to see where the grand jury had convened 3 days after the lynching and no one had been indicted. And I was able to keep up with things that's was going on like that by reading these contraband newspapers.
And once you were released from prison, you went back and interviewed people that might have been there knew were there?
That I hoped I might find somebody was there, and I did. I found a lot of people.
Did you find people wanted to talk about the lynching?
Yes, and I found some that didn't want to talk about it.
Now, where did you get the idea for the Black Holocaust Museum, which is now in Milwaukee?
My wife and I were traveling several years ago, in 1979 to be exact, and we visited the Jewish Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. And when I came out of there, I was so emotionally disturbed I couldn't hardly talk. But I told my wife, I said, "Honey, we need a museum like this in America to show what had happened to us black people and freedom-loving white people who've been trying to help us in our fight for equality in this country."
Now, where do you get the artifacts and what kinds of...
Send them to me. People send me artifacts. They look up in their closets or in their trunks and find descriptions of lynchings and pictures of lynchings. They find books about black and white people that they haven't used for years, and they send them to me. Even white people send me things. I have Ku Klux Klan robes and skulls, you know, gold skulls that they use for tie pins or lapel button. Wallets and belt buckles and a whole bunch of stuff.
You were pardoned by the governor of Indiana last year in 1993, the state saying that they had forgiven you.
Yes.
Do you forgive the state?
Yes, I did. You should read my acceptance speeches in my book, A Time of Terror. they have an appendix in there, the speech I made when I accepted this pardon that Governor Edward Evan Bayh had so graciously bestowed upon me. I told them that since Indiana had forgiven me, I, in turn, forgive Indiana for their indiscretions.
Well, I thank you very much, James Cameron, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
James Cameron's book is called A Time of Terror, published by Black Classic Press in Baltimore. He's also the founder of America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee. Billie Holiday's song Strange Fruit, with lyrics by poet Lewis Allen, was inspired by the many lynchings that took place in the South. This performance was recorded in 1946.
Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh, then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rise, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering on the show today. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. The very first thing we're going to do is hear who the president has appointed as his new counsel. We assume it's going to be Lloyd Cutler. Mara Liasson will be on the line live from the White House to let us know what happened. We also will talk to a Republican senator who wants to hold hearings on Whitewater in the United States Senate. And we'll continue to shop around for health plans. This time we're going to hear from Senator Paul Wellstone, who will describe the single-payer plan. And we will have a musical interlude from the Nature Boys of Samoa.
Linda, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In his previous books, The Moronic Inferno and Money, Martin Amis ridiculed American accents, American television, and American cities. In his latest book of essays, American Culture, among other things, doesn't fare much better. Commentator Maureen Carrigan wonders why we keep letting this man in the country.
It probably says something bad about our national self-esteem that Martin Amis's novels and essays sell so well over here. Amis is another in that long line of literary Brits who like to tour the U.S. and then write amusing books about how dumb, greedy, rude, garishly dressed, and just plain lame we Americans are. Dickens excelled at this kind of thing. So did Robert Louis Stevenson, Bram Stoker, and Evelyn Waugh. Reading Martin Amis's brilliant but withering descriptions of the U.S. have always made me think of the question Calvin Trillin posed after squirming through a performance by the French mime Marcel Marceau. Trillin asked, "Who keeps giving this guy a green card?" In visiting Mrs. Nabokov, Amis himself seems worried about the possibility of wearing out his welcome. His satire here is more cross-cultural. Though he sniffs at silly American tennis fans who dress in tennis togs to watch the game, he also notes the well-heeled crowds at Wimbledon always smell like damp dog. Along with his warts-and-all interviews of American writers like John Updike and the late Isaac Asimov, Amis also recalls encounters of the boozy kind with now-departed Brits Anthony Burgess and Graham Greene. And he warmly remembers a snooker game Esquire magazine paid him to play with buddy Julian Barnes, as well as a poker game GQ paid him to play with, among others, David Mamet. Oh, what fun it sounds like here to be a boy writer. As this sampling suggests, visiting Mrs. Nabokov is an uneven collection. Throwaway pieces like the two I just mentioned jostle side by side with gems like Amis's elegy for John Lennon. But to tell you the truth, Amis could publish a book of essays about how fabric softener works, and I'd read it. Part of Amis's wizardry lies in his power to conjure up whole comic situations in one unexpected word choice. For example, in an interview with the then 90-year-old writer V.S. Pritchett, Amis describes Pritchett's laugh as fizzy, his house as being fresher smelling than many a furnace the elderly inhabit, and his latest hefty short story collection as practically cuboid. Over the years, Amis has also created a disarming authorial persona, one that lets him get away with saying so many nasty things. He typically sounds like J. Alfred Prufrock on Prozac, fearful of the modern world, but determined to make himself go out there and eat a peach. But you always get the sense that, given his druthers, Amis would prefer to stay home. Maybe that's why he has such an imaginative empathy for Salman Rushdie. Amis writes that he often consoles his friend Rushdie by telling him, "If the Rushdie affair were the Amis affair, then I would, by now, be a tearful and tranquilized 300-pounder with no eyelashes or nostril hairs and covered in blotches and burns from various misadventures with the syringe and crack pipe." It's not that Amis wants to trade places with Rushdie. It's just that he seems to have given the fantasy of being permanently housebound an awful lot of thought. Taken together, the essays in Visiting Mrs. Nabokov may not be Martin Amis at warp speed, but to me, even his mediocre stuff makes almost everybody else seem sluggish.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the siege in Sarajevo through the eyes of a young girl. We talk with Zlata Filipovic about her book, Zlata's Diary. Zlata and her parents left Sarajevo in 1993 and now live in Paris. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.